Hello and welcome to another edition of Colour at Globe. This is Magda Zenon recording from Nicosia, and with me via Zoom from London we have Tatiana Der Avedishian. Welcome, Tatiana.
Hi Magda, great to be here.
It's lovely to eventually speak to you because I've been following you online because we're similar in lots of ways and different in a lot of ways. But the thing that joins us is gender and the discrimination that women face at every level and in all sectors. To put the listeners into the picture, introduce yourself.
Yes, of course. I'm a communications and sustainability expert. I work for the Economist Group. I'm heading up business development for the World Ocean Initiative, which is a mission-driven project of the Economist that looks at how to transition to a sustainable ocean economy. I also have my own consultancy where I advise on strategic communications and helping develop business strategies for organizations and sit on the board of a number of different nonprofits.
Your most recent project or commission is that you're advising the G7 on various issues related to gender and discrimination. Tell us about that, because I found it most interesting talking to you about this before the start of this podcast.
Yeah, so I was off the back of the work I did to advise the W20, the G20's Women's 20 Engagement Group. This is the official Gender Equality Engagement Group of the G20. I was appointed by Italy, who has the presidency of the G7 this year, to also advise them on the W7 policy recommendations. So given my expertise is on sustainability and specifically climate, they asked me to be one of the co-chairs for the Climate Justice Task Force for the W7 this year.
And what kind of recommendations did you make? Because I know sustainability and climate change is very much what you do, and it's also in being a peace and security expert. I also know that you can actually join all three to make it a lot more effective, and you need to join all three. You need to join gender discrimination, climate change, and women, peace and security. You need to be talking about it together and not separately, because they aren't separate issues.
Yeah, and I think that you've hit the nail on the head, because one of my biggest pain points is how we like to silo off different issues as if they're exclusive to one particular area of work. And in fact, we don't realize the interconnectedness and interdependencies of these big issues. So climate change, while people think it's just an environmental sort of effort, it actually directly links to national security and global geopolitical challenges that we're seeing unfold in front of us in real time. And then, of course, health. The impact of, one cannot ignore that that COVID-19, whether you believe it came out of a lab or it came out of a market, was directly linked to health and the environment, reversely. So in terms of recommendations for the W7, and it hasn't been released and officially yet, but many of the issues is looking at making sure that women in all their diversity, and that includes indigenous populations and trans and all sort of members of our gender, are equally represented in all areas of decision making, that there is enough allocation of funds going towards women-based organizations, that we are acknowledging the important role that women play in dealing with climate change. Many of them tend to be on the front lines, so they are the ones who are most impacted. They are also the ones that tend to be the main breadwinners in smaller communities and indigenous populations.
And so can I interrupt you there? They are the ones that are most impacted, which means they are the ones whose voices should be heard when solutions are being made, are being looked for.
Absolutely. Okay?
And I mean, that's as a woman peace and security activist, we need to keep on reminding the policymakers that the first responders, the most impacted, the first impacted are the people on the ground, and it's usually the mothers with families or the grandmothers. It's the community leaders. And they need to have a voice because they know what they need. Now they know what went wrong.
Yeah, they are. And I think like it's even it's not even that they don't even, sometimes organizations, even with the best intentions, kind of go in thinking that they've got solutions. And you know, sometimes the solutions are with the local community. And it doesn't mean reinventing the wheel. It just means that you've got to engage with your local community and understand, you know, how they're dealing with certain things. And sometimes historically, these indigenous communities, they already have the solutions, but nobody's asked them, or nobody's sort of giving them the money to kind of scale that solution into something more sustainable. And I think that, again, that's something that we need to bear in mind when we talk about when we talk about these issues.
I agree with you because I'm part of a few regional women peace mediators network, and I will listen to the woman from Southeast Asia or the woman from Africa, and what they're doing on the ground is astounding. It's absolutely astounding. And a lot of the time it's simple. It's not complicated, but it needs funding. It also needs people to be listening to them. They do need the support from the people around or the people that are making the decisions. So to me, I listen to them and I think, why didn't someone else think of that? Simple solutions, practical solutions, and a little bit of money. You do, and as someone who's working in peace, money is such an issue because they cut the money. They think they've got money shortages, and the first thing they cut is funding women's projects or
And
women's rights projects.
100%. And in fact, I always argue this: there isn't a lack of funds. There's enough money to go around. It's just that they do not get implemented or put into always the right kinds of projects, which is something that I find very frustrating because, you know, the people who are making these decisions are not necessarily thinking about the gender nexus. I mean, you know, for context, I always use this as an example, but I had someone I used to work with who looked at me very, you know, right in the face and said to me, "I don't understand what gender has to do with the blue economy." And, you know, I was confounded by it, but I thought to myself, my God, do you know how much work we've got to do if we've got to just basically explain the basics of why the gender nexus impacts, you know, impacts the our ability to deal with climate and our ability to sort of transition to what we want to, what we're calling an ocean, a sustainable ocean economy. So there's a lot of work to be done that is educating people about the gender nexus.
I mean, I was invited to speak at a conference recently, and I'm not going to name the conference, but he told me to put a title for myself. So I said, I wear a lot of hats, so what title would you want? Human rights activist, peace activist, feminist. He says to me, don't put feminist. We've got an equal number of women and men. And I thought, you know what, if I've actually got to explain to you that just because I'm biologically born a woman, it makes me a feminist or I have a gender perspective, I'm not even going to go that way. So this thing that it's just because you're biologically a woman, you think you're a feminist, or people perceive you as a feminist, is the tragic beginning. It's a
Well,
tragic beginning.
it is, and it's there's actually, you know, there's all I think we're living in a world today like the current feminist wave, and I don't know how we would define it if we were going to look if we wanted to look if we were to look back on it in the future, what we would define it as. But the word feminism in the last 20 years has become a really it's synonymous with like people sort of imagine it as an ugly word. And
Exactly.
you see younger women and even women in my own age group and women probably in your own age group who try to disassociate themselves from being called a feminist. And you know, it's quite sad because actually the word in itself, at least to me, you define it as an individual. You define it. I mean, I think we all women should consider themselves feminist, not that they all do, but also nobody owns that definition per se. It's how you choose to define that. And I think that, yeah, a lot of people say to me, I've even heard women say to me that, oh, but you know, we've achieved a lot of things, you know, what are we all still moaning about? And in fact, we haven't achieved a lot. We've achieved quite significant sort of changes, but not significant enough that we're seeing the impact on our economy, on women's livelihoods. And not just in the global, you know, global south, but also in the global north.
I agree with you. Feminism has got such a bad rap, and It's also got a bad rap in the sense that men feel threatened because there's an assumption that if you're a feminist, you're taking something away from them. And yet, all feminism is, in its true, pure sense, is that equal rights for everyone, equal rights. And it's as simple as that. It's if you've got the qualifications, if there are the structures, you can do the job or you can access the rights. It's got nothing to do with taking away from anyone. It's
No,
giving to every. It's giving to everyone, in fact.
it's building, so we use the word equity these days because we're trying to sort of demonstrate that, we cannot make all things equal, but we can make them equitable. And I think that, to your point, where, I always say this, I say this to men sometimes, especially the men that are, I have a lot of female male champions, which I'm proud to know that I have some wonderful men around me that support women. But to the other men, I always say to them, I'm like, I don't sort of want to see a world where we're not all cohabiting, because that's just that takes away from my own philosophy as what I believe is human rights. But moreover, we have to make sure that men are part of this conversation, because men are a key component of ensuring we reach equity.
No, I agree with you. This is a partnership. It's not you or me. It's us together. So I agree with you. We need men around us as allies and champions. And we're going to do this together, because in doing this together, we're all going to benefit. It's not one benefiting over the other. Because we have limited time, I'm going to take you to what we were discussing before and tell me, where does gender discrimination, at what age does gender discrimination start affecting us negatively as women?
How does it
Where does it
affect?
start? Where does it start and where does it end?
Well,
And does
can
it end?
I say that it starts at birth? And do you know what? I mean, I don't want to make, I obviously this is a very, very multi-layered, complex issue, but depending on where you were born in this world, depending on what socioeconomic background you were born into, all of these things matter, and sometimes they don't matter at all. And obviously, even religion comes into play in this. But I think that discrimination can start from birth all the way through till you sort of reach old age. I look at, and I'm going to give an example here. Many boomer women didn't necessarily work because they were still of that generation where the husbands were sort of, the main breadwinners. What has resulted in that is that you don't have the sort of level of financial literacy that you would anticipate women to have. So women my age group, and you'd be surprised though, because there's a lot of women who my age group don't have financial literacy. They're not, they haven't really figured out how to sort of, to think about investments, to think about, what is my net worth? What should my net worth be in 10 years? What kind of investments do I need to make? What kind of pension fund do I need to have? And so when women, many of these the boomer generation, many of these husbands who have passed, these women are sort of left to their own devices, and without having the kind of right tools to understand how to do financial management, they're exposed, and sometimes it leads to sort of them falling down the income sort of level because they haven't been able to manage finances, or they haven't understood some of the key challenges. And I blame them, and I blame, their partners for not thinking that it's important to educate themselves on these issues. But that's just one example of the sort of discrimination that you end up seeing in that generation. And I think from a younger generation, it's telling women not to be ambitious enough, or not to sort of strive for certain careers or certain subjects at university, because it's going to be a lot of work. And is this something that you want to do? And I actually met a girl from China recently at the World Ocean Summit who this was exactly what had happened to her. She wanted to go study marine biology, I think it was, and her family had put her off and said to her, that's not something that is going to, that's not really a career for a young girl. And she ended up going and doing something else, only to come to the realization that she was not fulfilling her own purpose. So she went back and she studied it, and she's now working and leading a foundation in China on that's linked to climate and biodiversity. So, not giving our children the enough our girls enough ambition to achieve that already puts them at in a disadvantage, and therefore they are discriminated when they enter the workforce. And again, that sort of brings on that cyclic challenge of how to get women further up the food chain into decision-making roles and into roles that really sort of create impact.
But it also takes you to the point we'd mentioned earlier that in your 30s, you're challenged because you're possibly going to have children, so that you don't want to be, you're not employable, you're not deemed employable. Yet we have systems in most countries that don't support women with children. Okay, and then once you get beyond the children, then your CV doesn't look that great. And nor does your contribution to social insurance. And then you come to my stage where I was pushed out of the corporate world because of my age, and I'm facing a dismal pension. And I'm also facing ageism because who employs a 66-year-old? And that goes back to what you said earlier. If I had slightly better financial literacy, I may have been in a better position, but not necessarily because there isn't a system around that supports anything except white, healthy, educated, middle-aged, heterosexual men. It's as simple as that. Okay. Take care.
Unfortunately.
And let's just touch quickly on the subject closer to your heart, but I know I will speak about this. To you, but you'll speak to me about this at a later stage in more detail. But talk to me about what is an ocean economy. It's something quite new to me and something we should all be thinking more about because ocean levels are dropping. What's in the ocean is dropping. Pollution is increasing. So, what can we do about it?
So it's funny. I think there's a friend of mine who said it best. Every second breath you take is from the ocean. And no matter how far away you live from the ocean, we are all dependent on it, whether we realize it or not. We all know this, we learned this in geography, but the earth is made, 70% of it is made up of water, and that is our ocean. So the ocean economy looks at all this, developing the blue economy, which is all these various different industries, whether it's the maritime sector, whether it's tourism, whether it's aquaculture and fisheries, to sort of managing, I guess, plastic pollution, renewable energy, especially in the blue energy space. But thinking about how you develop this economy with the health of the ocean in your mind. So you're everything that you're doing is you're helping to sustainably grow these economies, but with the health of the ocean first at the front of your mind. That is one way of sort of simply defining it, I would say. There are official definitions and they do vary. You can go to the World Bank and the Commonwealth have different ones. I think Cyprus, it's interesting. Cyprus to me is a blue economy. It should have a clear focus on the blue economy. I have been told that there's a strategy around how it's going to grow that. But I don't think that I haven't seen anything meaningful come out of this. But interestingly, Cyprus last week hosted the first ocean ministerial meeting for the Commonwealth late last week. It was a resounding success. I did see some articles about it, like in Gathe Merini. But I think that when we think about it, we're not always, especially in Cyprus, we're not as environmentally clued up. We
No,
don't
we're not. We're not.
think about climate change as a big issue, despite the fact that we are literally, living on the front lines of it and experiencing it. And we don't think about the important role that how reliant we are on this blue economy. So Cyprus, following the Commonwealth meeting, Cyprus is going to be leading on the aquaculture sort of efforts. And if we think about food security, for example, how are we going to feed the global population? Well, aquaculture plays a huge part in that, potentially. So we need to sort of think about that. We need to think about this biodiversity loss. We need to think about coral reef restoration and the importance of maintaining our corals because these things help keep us alive. They also build coastal resilience. Cyprus is heavily dependent on tourism. If we don't have healthy seas, who's coming to
Who's
visit
going to
us?
visit us?
So all these developers that are sort of pushing back on conservation efforts by, and I mean ironically by government, have failed to understand that their business is only as sustainable as our coastlines are resilient, and as you
They
know
haven't
the
failed to understand. What they understand is the money in their pockets, and it's very short term. They're looking at what's
absolutely.
going to happen in the next 10 years, and they're not looking at what's going to happen to their kids or what's going to happen to the.
And we don't think about infrastructure in that way either, like coastal infrastructure. We're not necessarily thinking about these big issues. Things get built haphazardly, you know. And this isn't, you know, this isn't me just sort of going on a rant and criticizing, but it's more about, you know, this is actually helping you think about how you can in perpetuity create a long-term business that del creates impact, but also makes you successful as a business leader. And so, you know, arbitrarily going off and sort of building projects, not taking into consideration the environmental impact, will only take you so far. But ultimately, if you're trying to create a long-lasting business with impact, then you've got to put the ocean at the heart of what you're doing. And so I think it's just a way of, I guess, changing the perception in ocean literacy. There's a huge effort that goes on around ocean literacy, and I think that this is a big part of it. When we talk about women and educating people on why, you know, there's a you know, why gender inclusivity matters, it's again, why does the ocean matter? How can we sort of educate people to understand that this isn't just about being kind to your environment, it affects your bottom line. If that's the only language that you understand, then let's put it out there and let's put the economics next to it and say this is why it matters, because 10 years down the line, this will impact your business and this will impact your livelihood.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you. There's no, they don't look at the big picture. They look at a very narrow picture. And a lot of the time, because I know, especially in Southeast Asia and in Africa, climate change and sometimes the ocean affects women directly because they farm the land, or they, and if they farm the land, but they have no control over the decisions made about what happens to that land and what's around it, then what's the use? Because men are making decisions based on not first responder knowledge or first
Absolutely.
impacted knowledge. They're making very academic or theoretical decisions. And I mean, especially the women in Southeast Asia, they farm most of the land. They farm most of the land, but they don't own it, which
Well,
means
they
that
don't.
the decision, what happens to that land practically, is someone else's decision.
And we don't empower women enough through, you know, climate funding. So to actually allocate funding to women to develop entrepreneurial solutions to some of these big issues. So what is it? Like 85% of women represent the seafood processing industry. So that's like, you know, from,
Wow,
you
that's
know,
a high, very high number.
that's a huge number. And so what we're facing in the, especially in the fisheries industry, you know, with the lack of practical sustainable fishing management, is directly impacting women. And then these women, to going back to your earlier point, which was that, you know, they are sometimes the main breadwinners. They are the leaders of these communities. They are then impacted. They are then able to, you know, their children are impacted. And so you go into that cyclic sort of challenge that we were talking about earlier.
Because we're running out of time, I'm going to give you the opportunity to say one thing you would like, what one message you would like to pass on. And I would also like to remind you, this is not the only conversation we're going to have. We'll make a plan later in the year to speak more specifically about the blue economy, which I find is really not spoken enough, especially in Cyprus. So one last message to women and climate change.
I think that we need to see more women rising up to the challenge to help solve the climate crisis. I want to see more women actively taking a front row seat in that negotiation process. And I'll go back, I'll say something here, which so there was a lady, first Black woman in Congress, Shirley Chisholm. And she actually tried to unsuccessfully run for presidency as well. My friend is her great niece. And when I met her, she gave me a little folding chair, like a little model folding chair. as Shirley Chisholm had a quote that if they don't, if they won't give you a seat at the table, take a chair with you. And what I would actively encourage all women to do when it comes to this, because because climate affects all of us, whether we like to believe it or not, is if you've got an idea and no one's giving you a seat at that table, take your folding chair and put yourself there. They can only kick you out, but at least they've heard you.
Okay, that's a lovely point to end on, and I agree with you. Always have that folding chair ready because there may be an opportunity to actually put your point across, regardless if they kick you out afterwards. You've had your say.
Thank you.
Tatiana, I'm really glad I made the effort to for us to connect. As I said, we will reconnect more because I think this question of climate change really needs a little bit more time. But I think
Agreed.
we've touched on a few points. Very grateful you made the time to be with us and look
Thank you.
forward to reconnecting with you soon.
Thank you, Magda. Me too, and well done for all the work that you're doing, because it's invaluable. It's truly invaluable.
We all
Thank you
play
for
our
having me.
part. We all play our
Yes.
part. It's the connection. And have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. Thank you.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening and have a lovely rest of the day.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open, diverse, free.